session number 22359, wheel 1.
Robert Taylor, reel 1, where were you born, please?
Portsmouth, Hampshire.
Which year was this?
1925. You'll have to excuse my...
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Portsmouth?
Well, yes, in the area. Starting off in Portsmouth and then Drayton and Porchester.
How old were you when you finished school?
14.
So that was just as war was breaking out?
That was the year... I left school in December 39. Did 3 months after the war started.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
I did. My mother and I were in the kitchen with the wireless on.
How do you feel about that?
Well, being 14 years of age, I thought it was a great thing. My mother almost burst into tears. And then told me off.
Did the war affect you at first?
When France fell and the Battle of Britain started, yes. It affected me personally very much.
In what way?
Well, I was dive-bombed in Portsmouth. Not myself, but it did feel like it. But they were actually attacking HMS Dolphin. But I happened to be going along the road from Hassler Hospital to HMS Dolphin, riding a bike.
Is that Portsmouth or Gosport?
Gosport.
How frightening was it?
Very, because it was the first time that I've had any thing like that. The baptism of fire.
What did they hit?
The bomb went into the mud alongside HMS Dolphin and HMS Hornet and didn't explode. And to my mind, it's probably there to this day.
Any other memories of the German air attacks in your area?
Oh, yes.
Can you tell me about them, please?
The Portsmouth Blitz. January the 10th, 1941. The Great Fire Blitz on Portsmouth, March the 10th, 1941. And on August the 12th, 1940, when the Luftwaffe attacked all the installations, radar installations along the south coast, and they attacked Portsmouth as well, I happened to be right in the middle of that, about 10 yards away from the dockyard.
What happened?
Well, my mate, who was 60-odd at the time, my workmate, I worked under him. I was 15, I think. Yeah, I was 15. We went down into the cellars and locked ourselves down into the cellars. But he'd forgotten the key. So he sent me up 3 flights of stairs to get the key, which means I had to traverse an oak beam in the street like this to get to each floor. And as I did so, machine gun bullets came all down the street. So that was another thing. I seemed to be picked out for it as a kid. It's just one of those things that happened to me.
But were you injured?
No. No, because I don't know if you can remember. You see, they're big Victory oak beams. And there was no doors. To get to the top floor of this building where I worked, you had to go to walk along a big thick oak beam and then go up onto the next floor. Well, the oak beam was right adjacent to the wall, and there was a street there, right underneath you. And that's where the bullets came. But I got the key and I got down. And we went downstairs into the cellars until it was over. That was the day that the harbour station got bombed and various things in the dockyard.
Was Portsmouth much damaged?
Yes, afterwards, during the night blitzes, yes. Not so bad as Plymouth, but it was, in fact, quite devastated. The Guildhall and all the big hotels and everything like that, all the big stores, all gone.
What was public morale like under the bombing?
Good. Yeah, the public morale was good. There's no doubt about that.
Was there any hatred of the German air crews?
I'll say, as far as I was concerned, yes. I could have torn them apart if I'd got my hands on them, but then that was just a natural reaction.
So, how did you come to be in the Navy?
Well, because of my experiences, I thought, I'll become a wireless operator air gunner. So, I went through various tests and a Morse code. You see, I'd learnt the Morse code in the Scout, so I passed A1 on that, Morse code and all that. And I knew a bit about the wireless from my days in the Scouts. But, unfortunately, my mathematics is absolutely zero. And that's what they wanted. So, in desperation, I thought, well, the time is going on and on and on. I've got to do something. So I volunteered for the Navy and passed A1.
So you've been hoping for the RAF?
Initially I did, yes. Solely to get back at the Luftwaffe. That was my idea.
What happened once you passed for the Navy?
Well, within weeks I was in.
Where were you trained?
HMS Royal Arthur.
Can you describe what it was like, please?
Yeah, HMS Royal Arthur was really Butlin's holiday camp at Skegness. And we used to be in all the chalets that the holiday people used to be in. I was only there for 6 weeks. That was initial training until they sorted out what job I was going to do. Then they made me a signalman, and then I went to HMS Scotia in Ayr in Scotland for about 4 months. Passed out as a signalman. They mushed you through. And then I went to sea. I was the first one in my class to get a draft to sea.
How did you cope with the training?
Oh, very well. I did enjoy it.
Why?
Because I enjoy being with my peers and taking part in all the activities.
How did you cope with the discipline?
Liked it. I thought it was right. And those who don't like discipline, well then they shouldn't be in the forces.
Which ship did you go to first?
Well, I've only been on one ship during the war, mind you, I've been on lots since. And that was Free French ship Renoncule. Been on there for 2 years.
What was it called?
Renoncule, which is French for ranunculus. Because it was a flower class corvette given to the Free French for the duration. And so it took its French name, which is Renoncule, which is Renoncule.
Where did you find the ship at first?
Well, I was sent for and told, you are going on draft to the Renoncule. I said, I've never heard of that. They said, well, you wouldn't because it's French. I thought, well, they didn't tell you anything. They didn't say that it was liaison. They didn't say this. They didn't say anything. They just said, go and get your hammock and your kit bag and be on the parade ground at so-and-so for the transport to Scotland. Well, off I went. And I arrived at Greenock. And there she was in the small ship's basin alongside another corvette. And I went on board with two others who'd been selected from the Royal Navy, two coders, and I was a signalman. And we went down, and as we approached the brow to go on board, the British Naval Liaison Officer, who was a lieutenant, RMVR, he was standing in the waist looking like this.
With his arms folded.
Yeah, looking, I thought, oh my God. So he said, are you Taylor? Which is obvious because it was the youngest one of the three. The other two were about 35 to 40 years of age. So he said, are you Taylor? I said, yes, sir. He said, have you been to sea before? And I said, no, sir. He said, oh, my God. What, am I being sent now? I thought, well, it's not my fault, mate. You know? So anyway, he wasn't too bad in the end.
Who was he?
Lieutenant Griffiths, RMVR. Came from Mould in North Wales.
Then what?
Well, then within days we were off to the New World with a convoy, and we went down to we went to Argentia, which is a base right up in the north near the Arctic Circle, but in Newfoundland. And the convoys were dispersed to Canada. Then we went down to Halifax, and instead of going back to Britain, we had to go all the way down to New Orleans, all the way down to Mexico, up the Mississippi with a pilot. And we had various things done to the ship in New Orleans. Then we left there, picked up a convoy up off Canada and back home. That was about 6 months.
What type of things were done to the new ship in New Orleans?
Oh, a good refit. A 2 month refit. Very quickly done by the United States Navy and dockyard people.
What did you think of the job they did?
Well, the ship was great afterwards. The like a car who gets a good service.
What was it like being ashore in America at that time?
Can I speak bluntly on this?
Certainly.
It's from those days that I've taken a great dislike of America and Americans.
Why is that?
Because being on my own, a British sailor on my own in a foreign country like America, and the other members of my liaison team being all married men, they congregated places like church halls and Flying Angel clubs and the PVX, which is NAFI and all that sort of thing, and wrote letters home and sat there and listened to music, which at 17 wasn't my cup of tea. Well, I was completely on my own, and on Christmas Day 1943, I roamed the streets of New Orleans with no one to talk to at all. No one. And when they talk about the Yanks coming over here and giving them plenty of help and inviting them in and all this, I think, yes, well, I could tell you a story about that from the other side. And since then, I'm afraid, and having worked with Americans during the war in the Free French Navy, because we were in the western part of England for D-Day under the Americans, and having seen their professional ability, in inverted commas, I'm afraid ever since my opinion of the United States and Americans is zero. And I'm sorry to have to say that, but we are talking frankly, aren't we?
Of course. So you mean you didn't find them efficient?
Oh, they never fit. Well, not really, because the whole thing about the United States Army and Navy is numbers. Swamping. They can swamp anything, whether it's, I mean, if you need a ship, then they give you 10. If you need a battalion, then they give you an army. And that's what it is. It's power and numbers. But apart from individual efficiency, I don't think that they come up to anything like the British. Unfortunately, we haven't got the power or the numbers. So we have to submit to their power and numbers. But when it comes to efficiency, then the British Navy and Army and RAF are far superior to them. That's my opinion. I mean, I might be wrong, but I've had a lot to do with Americans over the 2 years I was in the Free French Navy. They have a bad opinion of them as well. You want to hear some of the French officers?
Why did being in the Free French Navy bring you into so much contact with Americans?
Well, after we'd done 6 convoys, which took us up to April 1944, right? That's the last big convoy. From April 44, we set sail on the 18th of April for Britain, and immediately were told that we were going to go into Western Approaches and the RSC and do exercises with the Americans for D-Day. Well, they didn't say D-Day, but they said for further operations. Naturally, they wouldn't say, for further operations. And we went with live ammunition, and we took part with the Americans and the British, and that lasted about 3 weeks. Really grueling, up and down, up and down. The RAF came down and fired rockets at us and the Americans. And that was the start of my operations with the Americans. I could tell you a few personal stories on my clash with Americans, but I mean, it wouldn't be anything to do with this.
Yes, I think it would. Just tell me, please.
Well, when I went to Argentia, when I'd done my first trip, my first convoy at 17, I was 17 and three quarters. And I got to Argentia in Newfoundland, which had been the great big United States base. And my liaison officer said, I want you to go ashore at freezing cold. He said, but I want you to dress right up well. Right up, he said, and go ashore and take this message to this chap, and Mr. Zimmerman. What was it? I don't know, but I can remember Mr. So-and-so Zimmerman, and block number whatever it was in the United States. I had to ask where it was, so I found it eventually. No problem. Well, Zimmerman to me is German. I goes waltzing in to this place with all the Yankee workmen all round there, with HMS on me hat and everything. And I waltz in full of the joys of spring, thinking everyone loves the Brits, because I've never had anything else. Yeah, everyone loves the Brits except the Germans. And then I said, could I speak to Mr. Zimmerman, please? And the chap said, hold on then. Hold on there, Limey. So I waited, and this chap came out, and he said, he grabbed it off me, and he said, get out of here, you C.S. Limey. Well, I was taken aback. He said, get out and stay out and don't come back here. Well, I was appalled. But two Yanks came over and said, oh, leave the kid alone. And took me out when I delivered the message. I thought, well, it's just going to be all right, how do you do? So, and it was the start of it.
Why was he so antagonistic?
Because I think he's, being Zimmerman, I think he was of German extraction. I just think he was. Mr. Zimmerman, Z-I-M-M-E-R-M-A-N. And well, he shouted and roared at me. And I just handed him a bloody letter. That's all it was. Since then, well, that's the start of my deterioration of with the United States.
So why had Ronald Keogh gone to Argentia?
Well, that's where the convoys normally ended up. There was all sorts of... There was HMS Beicher, one of those little aircraft carriers. There was all sorts of British ships there. And us. The escorts, like, you know, of that particular convoy waiting to return. Except that we didn't.
So, you first went to sea in Renoncule. What was it like being at sea for the first time?
Well, bad enough as it was, strange. But doubly so because of a French crew. And not being able to speak a word of French, you wondered why you were sent there by the Admiralty. And the captain cleared lower deck and he had us all there and he said, we can't teach you French. If you're in action, You just have to guess what we say and learn as fast as you can. And luckily, I had a French friend who I... Well, he was a French signalman. And the two of us, we used to be on watch together sometimes. And when it was quiet, he used to teach me German and French. Well, enough to get by.
German and French?
German and French, yes. Yes, because he was an Alsace. Yes, he came from Alsace and Lorraine. So he taught me both languages. Well, not taught me them, but got me by.
So you ended up speaking fair French?
Rudimentary.
Can you tell me about the job you had to do aboard?
Yes, I was a signalman, which meant that my action stations was on the bridge, on the signal protectors, and the flag lockers, and the chart room, which had all the coding books and everything like that. And that was my duties. One of us on the port side and another signalman on the starboard side. I was normally on the port side. And when a flashing message came through, or we had to flash a message, that was my job. You've seen them on the flashing lights. The Morse code. And that signalman's duties generally.
Did you say flag lockers?
Yes, we had flag lockers, so that you could grab the flags and hoist them on and haul them up. You know, in answer to a message from another ship, the convoy escort officer, who was normally British on a British ship. He would hoist a signal giving our speed, and then we would reply, George 1-0, which is 10 knots, things like that. Didn't have to use the flags very often.
So these were metal lockers where they kept flags, signal flags?
Just an open locker with a canvas flap down for the weather, and about 26 little things, A to Z. And then a couple of extra flags for different things which the Yanks had introduced, naturally. and you just pulled a flag out that you wanted. So you wanted flag Able and flag Zebra. You just grabbed them, hoisted them, and then pulled them right up to the masthead, and the flag spilled out and gave a message to the other ships, or answered the senior officer.
You mean you attach the flag to a rope, the flags to a rope?
Yes, so you know the halyards that come down from the top of the mast, or from the yardarms, right? They're called halyards, and they've got clips on either end, and you just clip the flags on, and it becomes longer, that's all, and you just haul them up to the very top. And if you lose them, you have to do what I do, and climb up onto the yardarm at sea. And I was in the English Channel in a storm, and I let go, and the halyard went right up to the top and stayed at the yardarm. And the law is, he who lets the halyard go, goes and retrieves it. So I had to climb up the mast on that little ladder that goes up, like that, it's about that big, and you climb up, and then you've got to lean out on the yardarm and inch your way across to where the halyard has been stuck. Pull it down and put it in your belt and climb down. Believe me, I've never... First there was the English Channel there, then there was the English Channel there, then there was a ship underneath me like that. Never want to go through that again. I don't like heights the best of time. But you just had to do it. Or you lose. You can't lose face in front of French.
So you made sure you didn't lose it again?
Oh, yes. I'll say. Made sure. You hang on to that as tight as you can until you got the flag on. Then you just look. Yes, it's okay. Then you let go and then pull the flags up. It's a lesson, that is.
How did the flags clip on?
You've got a head of attack. It's a long time ago. You've got a swivel head, about that big. Swivel head, right? Clip, yeah. And then on the other end, you've got just an ordinary cleat affair like that. And the two go on like that, and that's it. And then you get the other end and put the next flag on, and so on. I can't explain his 60 years.
So did you not enjoy being on the ship?
Oh, yes. I enjoyed being ashore with my French friends, because although the English chaps on board, the British chaps on board, they were friendly, great. But they were old. They didn't want me around when they went ashore. They didn't want me around. They were somber and all this sort of thing. They're thinking of their wives and their wives at home and all that. But I was fancy free and I wanted to see life. I just joined the Navy, wanted to see life. So naturally, I made friends with about three or four French men and went ashore with them. Had a drink in a pub, went out, had some fun. Things that I'd never have done with my mates in the Liaison Staff. Yeah, 24. I think the youngest was about 24. And the other one, poor old a chap from Wales, he'd been called up and he was 40-odd. He didn't want me around. He wanted to sit there and darling so-and-so all the time. Okay? So naturally I was forced, literally forced into the company of my French friends, who did me well. The thing was, I was getting 10 shillings one fortnight and a pound the next. Well, it didn't go very far, but my French friends always saw me all right.
So they gave you money?
No. They didn't give me money. They just treated me to a drink. Oh, no, it's all right. It was Young'un, everyone called me. It's all right, Young'un. No. No, yeah, have a drink on me.
So they said Young'un?
Young'un. Young one.
In English?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, it got through the ship. So they called me Young'un. Everyone called me Young'un. Except the officers, who called me Taylor.
What about running into the enemy at sea?
Yeah, we had some contacts with the U-boats, and we had a, what they would call a positive. I've got some papers about that. The running crew was awarded a positive strike on this U-boat. But we had about, you see, the awful part about being at sea, seeing a corvette, is that you can never know for fully if you sunk a U-boat. Not unless the U-boat comes to the surface and then dives. Even if oil comes up and pieces of the clothing, you can't say that you sunk a U-boat, because they just do that as a roost. They just send up clothes and oil. You never know if you sunk the U-boat unless the ASDIC person reports complete loss of contact after you've depth charged, and if there's no response, it's quite possible that it's gone to the bottom. But you can never know. And the trouble with being on a French corvette, and this is what I said in that book, but mind you, it wasn't published. That part wasn't published. It's happened about three or four times. We've had a nice contact on a U-boat, and we've got up and down, dropping lots of depth charges, up and down over the contact, depth charges, right? And just when we think we're going to make it, the inevitable happens. A British ship comes along from the convoy, one of the escorts, who's always senior to the French corvettes anyway, and says, "You carry on in your place on the convoy and we'll take over." And as I said in that book, to the greater glory of the British Navy. So we never get a chance. We're always frustrated. either by the U-boat or we're frustrated by the British ships telling us to get back and we'll do the job. Well, you can imagine, British as we are, no one more patriotic than I am, but that immediately made the French and the British as one. And we used to say, oh no, not again. Why don't they leave us alone to get on with the job that we've just started? And that happened about three times. In fact, I remember saying, oh no, look. And there came a British frigate. Ah dear, it was so frustrating, that was. But we did hear after the war that was given us, one of them, as a death.